next installment of the SUS News podcast series, where we interview newsmakers and discuss the news and applications relevant to the global unmanned technologies community. I'm your program host, Patrick Egan, and this is where we would usually say hello to our a big Texas hello to our co-host, Gene Robinson. But this week, and as we speak, Gene Robinson is on his way to the UN to talk about the humanitarian applications for unmanned aircraft systems. And I can't think of anybody better, because Gene spent many moons in the field with this technology and the applications. So it's good that we've got somebody up there with some empirical knowledge representing the community. I'm happy for that. So what we're going to do is we usually talk about the news, but now we're just going to launch in to the program and speak with our guest, Mr. Ted McGeer from Aerovel. Ted's been around for a little while, and I think this ought to be an interesting conversation, get a little perspective on the industry and the technology. So, Ted, could you please maybe come on and tell the listeners a little bit about your background and yourself and how you became involved with unmanned aircraft systems?
Hello, Patrick. Thanks for that. Hello to your listeners from the Columbia River Gorge, where I'm at the moment wandering along the grass runway with my dogs at our Aerovel headquarters in Houston, Washington. I'm running a little company of a dozen people out of a house here in Southern Washington, and we're developing a new unmanned aircraft, primarily for civil applications, something I've been trying to make happen for 25 years. Hopefully this aircraft is going to have the economy necessary to make that a reality.
All right, so here we're going to flash back. When you first got into this business 25 years ago, what were they called?
I suppose at that point they were called unmanned aircraft. They had been called drones for decades before that. Now I guess they're called drones again, but a rose by any name would sell as sweet or as sour, depending on your point of view.
That's true. I kind of judge people's, let's say, you know, along the timeline, the participation timeline, when people are like, I'm like, well, what were they called when you first got it? Well, they were remotely piloted vehicles. Or they were remotely piloted aircraft, or they were unmanned UAVs, or whatever. The nomenclature keeps changing, and that seems like the only progress we're getting out of all of the airspace integration initiative. But,
as we're on this subject, briefly, I'll digress and tell you that at one point, 20-odd years ago, we were involved with NASA, and NASA realized, of course, that unmanned was a sexist term, which is vitally important for them not to be sexist. It's much more important to worry about those things than to worry about things like manned spaceflight. So consequently, they decided the U should stand for uninhabited. So they were uninhabited air vehicles. I guess you didn't count the microorganisms that might be on board.
That's true. But that's funny perspective that you say that, because it's funny how encompassing this is. And I'm sure we'll get more into that. Now, the funny thing is, as you know, I was talking a little bit before we went live. A lot of people think this drone thing kicked off like last year. You know, and I was at Brookstone and I got into drones. I bought myself a Parrot and I started flying it around in the yard. Nah, these drones are great. And I get grad students all the time, and they're like, oh, you know, can we interview you, Mr. Egan? We want to talk about all the potential firsts with this technology and when people are going to start doing stuff with the technology. And I use you as an example a lot of the time. You're my there's this great picture I keep telling people about, and you sent it to me. If I call you the garage tinkerer, and there's that picture with the Aerosonde on the bench in the garage, which I want to get into. Yeah. But a lot of these people are like, oh, you know, when are we going to do this and when are we going to do that? And I'm like, geez, you know, a lot of that stuff's already been done. And I want to talk about the transatlantic flight a little bit, if you'll indulge us with that. Maybe you could go into the history of that, when it happened and how that went down, because a lot of people don't know about it.
Well, the story is that in 1998, we flew an Aerosonde from Newfoundland to Scotland. It was the first flight across the Atlantic by an unmanned aircraft. And we did it to make a point about the practicality of flying small aircraft long distances. At that point, this had been a few years after I started a company called In Situ. And we were developing, as you said, an aircraft called Aerosonde, which was intended to do long-range weather reconnaissance over oceans and remote areas, going to hurricanes and so on. And so I had been for several years doing small-scale trials with Aerosonde and going to meteorologists and saying, look, it's a perfectly practical thing to do to fly these aircraft very long distances. And we thought that in order to get credibility, we better actually do that. So we said, well, historically, the way you demonstrate that you've achieved a significant milestone is by flying across the Atlantic. So we flew across the Atlantic. It happened to be the first time an unmanned aircraft had done that. Not, by the way, the first time a robotic aircraft had done it. The first time a flight across the Atlantic had been done without anybody touching the primary flight controls had been in the late 40s on a DC-4.
So now I know it took more. Didn't it take more than one attempt? I heard there was a deal where the story kind of expanded that there was a, I guess with wind and whatever else, and meeting the airplane and things like that. Where there was a little bit more drama to it than the story you just related.
Yeah, we lost. I forgot. No, two aircraft doing it. It was not because there was any doubt about the aircraft having enough range and endurance to get across the Atlantic. It was rather because through that whole period that we'd been developing the aircraft, we were very badly underfunded. There was never money to do proper engineering. There was always money maybe to cobble together some aircraft to do some sort of meteorological trial. And the consequence of that is we were always flying prototypes that were kind of stuck together with baling wire and chewing gum. And reliability was a big problem because until you do it proper engineering, you don't get reliability. It's still a huge problem with unmanned aircraft. So we had, by that time, done several hundred flight hours and tests and so forth, and we had got to a failure rate of about 1 in 50 hours. And between a generator belt coming on or some lubrication problem, what have you. Well, anyway, so we had a 50-hour mean time between failure, roughly, and it only took 25 hours to cross the Atlantic. So if you say, well, okay, if we bring four aircraft, then our chance of getting one across is somewhere in the high 90s. So that's what we did.
That's pretty funny. And, you know, it's kind of an interesting history that, that I think needed to get out there because the other one that really, you know, a lot of these stories that I read now in the news, people are like, oh, you know, I got these military, the drones, military, and we're, you know, beating the plowshares. And I'm like, that's not always the case. And that leads us to the next aircraft that some people might know. And I wanted to talk about the In Situ company and your participation in that and the next aircraft that came out of that and what, let's say, the concept for operations or missions was with the aircraft that were coming out of that company.
Well, we've done Aerosonde for a few years. That's why In Situ had been started. I started In Situ in the early 1990s specifically to develop this idea of a very small but very long-range aircraft. I mean, long-range crossing the Atlantic, right? Thousands of kilometers in a couple of days endurance. That's what you need if you want to do hurricane reconnaissance. And the motive, by the way, for doing hurricane reconnaissance is that making in-situ measurements inside the storm. In-situ is, of course, where the name of the company came from, is quite important for forecasting. So this is why in the United States we have a squadron of C-130s. You can watch on Discovery Channel, whatever, Hurricane Hunters, flying into hurricanes to get this information. And that's fine, except flying a squadron of C-130s is a very expensive business, and they're tens of millions of dollars per year. So there's only a limited amount of that the United States can do, and people in other threatened areas, the Western Pacific, the Indian Ocean, and so on, can't afford it at all, so there's no in-situ measurement going on there. And the concept behind Aerosonde was that for hurricanes and for other more routine weather kind of observations, If you use a small aircraft, you get the data much less expensively. And I think we've demonstrated technically that that would be quite feasible, and perhaps economically too. But unfortunately, the customer was the Weather Service, Weather Service in this country and Weather Services around the world. And unfortunately, governments are rather slow to make decisions. I'm afraid you guys should know. It's all too telling. So after 5-6 years of doing that, I eventually concluded that we weren't going to get anywhere and got out of the weather reconnaissance business. That was in 1999. Well, here it is 15 years later, and unfortunately, very sad to say, what I concluded at that time is being all too true. NOAA is now talking about their unmanned aircraft program. They've been doing it for years, and it's like every year it's new. They started from some fresh concept. Oh, we can. There's this wonderful new thing called unmanned aircraft, and let's think about what we can do with it. What we did in the 90s is long forgotten. Anyway, so that's why I got out of the weather business and decided, boy, it would really be nice to find a private customer who really needs to get a job done, and if you can demonstrate you can do it, then you can have lunch and make a deal. Well, after we crossed the Atlantic, there was a certain amount of publicity, and people started calling, could you do this, could you do that? And one of the more interesting suggestions that came our way was to do imaging reconnaissance off tuna boats. There are hundreds of these boats around the world. Many of them are using helicopters to go find fish and killing people at an absolutely astounding rate. I mean, if your chances of getting killed when you drove to work were the same as the chances these guys face when they get in the helicopter, you wouldn't be going to work. It's absolute madness. We thought, well, okay, maybe we can solve that problem. That's what led to this aircraft, now called Scan Eagle.
Well, you know, it's flashing back to the Aerosan thing. The other thing with the Aerosan, and I've had other scientists on the program, and really, you know, people always ask me, what's your favorite thing about the program? And I go, really, when you get these guys spooled up on their specialty is really when it gets kind of exciting. And it's interesting you talk about the hurricane thing, because we've had a couple of scientists on the program who've been using the technology, and they're like, oh, you know, you can gather data, unprecedented data that you've never been able to grab before, because you can't, you know, fly a manned aircraft, you know, a few feet off the water. And I get to learn how hurricanes form and the energy comes out of the sea and yada, 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 but all of the rest of this. So that's another thing that the unmanned aircraft affords the, let's say, researcher, is data that you wouldn't be able to get any other way. And
absolutely. But we were saying that exact thing 25 years ago. And technically, it's become somewhat easier to do what we were talking about 25 years ago. It's easier now than it was then, but it's not the difference between night and day. What made the difference between night and day, by the way, was the advent of GPS. The advent of GPS was circa 1990. Since then, there have been significant steps, but still, we could have been doing hurricane reconnaissance, low level, high level, whatever, with Aerosondes in the mid-90s. So you have to ask, well, why hasn't it happened now? And a large part of the answer has to do with economics.
Right. Well, there's economics, and there's also, I mean, there was another story about, you know, another hurricane story in Aerosonde, and I think it was a partnership between NASA and probably the weather, NOAA or something, I forget. But anyway, they got a COA, and maybe you remember this story, they got a COA to fly an Aerosonde in a hurricane. And they were out there getting this unprecedented data, and they decided, they were like, oh, you know, we've never seen anything like this, so we're going to sacrifice the vehicle to collect data. And the FAA revoked their COA because they went beyond the reserve fuel limit. And, you know, they're like, that's it. We're pulling your dance card. And, I mean, I don't know.
I haven't heard that story, but I can't tell you that the first hurricane reconnaissances by Aerosonde were flown in 2001. There was one off the East Coast of the United States, and there was one in Taiwan. And the first flights into the eyes of tropical cyclone were flown in 2005. Again, one flight in Taiwan and one off the East Coast of the United States. So well, again, this was demonstrated a long time ago.
Right, and a lot of these firsts were before, and I want to kind of get into that, because you always, you know, there's a quote about the Scan Eagle, you know, yes, that was developed, and I hope everybody got that, for more of the idea of doing some tuna fishing. And, you know, before I had heard that, you know, I did a little research after that, but I didn't realize that tuna, you know, were worth so much, but I guess that's why people risk life and limb with the helicopters to go find the fish. But, yep. You know, okay, so that brings us back to here you are, you know, here's our you know, quintessential grudge tinker, and you're working on the Scan Eagle, and you want to do the fishing thing, and maybe you could give us a little historical perspective of when that was going down, and you know, maybe some of the trials
and tribulations. Well, this was all happening in the early 2000s, and we got some private investors, or angel investors, who put up a couple million dollars, and we developed the aircraft, and there was interest, as we expected, from people in tuna fishing. Then we had a close partnership with a company in Geological Survey, and it looked like there was a reasonable chance of those applications coming forward. Then Mr. Bush invaded Iraq, and the company very quickly became a defense contractor, because that's where the market was. It was a decision made by the board of directors of the company to concentrate on the military application. It was a reasonable business decision. It was not one that I was thrilled about.
Right,
anyway, the consequence of that is that Insitu is now a defense contractor, and we never did fly on a tuna boat.
Well, it's funny how things change, and we have spoken about that in the past, and I'm sure, you know, you want to develop things, you want to do things, and people come along, and there's partnerships or whatever else, but I think it's important to establish that, you know, basically that thing was developed for, let's say, civilian purposes. Never achieved that goal, but we're going to get there. There's still time on the clock, and we're going to get there. The other thing is there's always, you know, when I first met Ted on the Small U.S. ARC, which was kind of fun. I don't know. I spent most of my time grousing about the whole process, and I wanted to get a little bit of your take on that. But I also, there was another quote where you talked about if we had this, the regulations or lack of regulations that exist now, that you've said in the past that Scan Eagle wouldn't exist. Would you like to elaborate on that?
Well, first, for your listeners, I'll explain what the ARC was. ARC stands for Advisory Regulatory Committee or some such thing. And it was constituted by the FAA, this particular one, in 2008 or thereabouts, to discuss what the rules should be for flying small unmanned aircraft within visual range. In other words, exactly what people flying radio-controlled models have been doing for decades. And it seemed to me that this was not a hard problem. All you had to do was go into the existing regs, and you do a search for the phrase for recreational purposes only, or whatever the actual term is, and you do a delete. And now you've changed the rules to accommodate flight within visual range. That's, of course, not what happened. You and I sat through many of those meetings where suggestions just came out of the air. Well, let's have Category A aircraft, which weighs 1.3 kilograms and fly below 200 feet, and Category B aircraft, which weighed up to 2.5 kilograms and fly below 400 feet on Tuesdays and so on. And there was no rationality to it at all. It was, well, I suppose, as supposedly Bismarck said, You don't want to watch sausages being made. You don't want to watch public policy being made. Well, that's what supposedly was going on there. Although, in the end, the recommendations of the ARC were thrown out anyway, and they ended up 5 years later, and there's still no sensible rules.
Well, that's funny. I think you've kind of captured the ARC kind of in a nutshell. And it was, you know, I try and tell people that, you know, they're like, well, you know, they're wringing their hands and, you know, well, what should we do, you know? And even as, let's say, not so far back, about a month ago, I was at in D.C. for a Beyond Visual Line of Sight committee meeting that the FAA put together, and you'll probably enjoy this. So, you know, we got 30 different groups in the room, and I said, you know, to the FAA representative now, and I'm risking getting kicked off that committee for talking about this, but I just thought it was kind of interesting. We're going to go and do this work. And I said, well, you know, for the sake of, you know, expediency and getting a product out here, is any chance the FAA defined the visual line of sight envelope? You know, it's still yeah. to be designed or defined. Okay, that's fine.
I think maybe for the benefit of your listeners, they should understand why there is a regulatory problem. So air regulations are all about safety. And they're about safety for three groups. People on board the aircraft, people on board other aircraft, and people on the ground, right?
Right.
Manned aircraft regulation primarily addresses the safety of people on the aircraft. That's appropriate. And when you take care of them, you pretty much take care of the other groups, too. Of course, with unmanned aircraft, you don't have to worry about the people on the aircraft. So the focus of regulation of safety shifts from the aircraft itself to what the aircraft might hit. Now that's a very different kind of problem than the regulators are used to thinking about. Because if you're worried about what the aircraft might hit, then risk and safety depend very much on where you're operating. If you're operating over a city, that's a very different prospect than operating out over a desert, right? If you're operating over a city, you need a much higher reliability than you do if you're operating over the ocean. And that's what needs to be captured. So the way I've suggested that it be done is that the rule should say nothing more than you must have liability insurance. And that means that insurance companies essentially take over the job of assessing risk. Now, you might say, are insurance companies competent to do that? My answer is probably more competent than the FAA because they actually have some skin in the game. They're not going to be perfect at it, but the FAA sure isn't either. This means that for any proposed operation, you would have to look at what is the risk. And your insurance company would choose its premiums appropriately. And what you would find with unmanned aircraft today is that if you were proposing to operate over the ocean or over a desert, you would find reasonable premiums. And the insurance cost would be a small part of your overall operating cost. If you were to say, well, let's go fly over the city for 12 hours taking pictures or whatever, given the unmanned aircraft reliability that has historically been demonstrated, you would find the premium is astronomical and you'd better instead go to the local airport and hire a 172. So this would be a way of both dealing with the regulatory conundrum and addressing the economic issues.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny, is that because, you know, it sounds like a pragmatic.
Well, you might
approach.
Recall I said basically that at the ARC, and people's eyes glazed over.
There was a few times that you know, it was pretty. There was a couple of times where, you know, you were talking about, you know, looking at this kind of like you said, you know, there's a probability and failures and where you're flying, and you're kind of looking at it. I would say taking a scientific approach, and I think you lost everyone in the room. That was one time. It was another time you started talking about physics, and everybody glazed over. People were running out of the room. And there were a couple of other times where you made suggestions, and people were like, oh, God, this guy, you know, he's crazy. And I'm like, well, I don't, you know, I mean, these are good ideas.
But these are not particularly difficult concepts. I'm sure on this program you have talked about sense and avoid, since that is a mantra that the FAA tends to chant a lot. And for many, I have heard it said by people who are supposedly authorities on the subject, that solving the sense and avoid problem, that is the mid-air collision problem, is the fundamental barrier towards widespread adoption of unmanned aircraft. The FAA calls for operation of unmanned aircraft with a level of safety equivalent to that of manned aircraft, the so-called equivalent level of safety threshold.
Right.
So let's look at what the level of safety is with respect to mid-air collisions for manned aircraft, particularly manned aircraft who are using this so-called see-and-avoid paradigm. And the answer is that for decades, quite consistently, aircraft flying VFR, supposedly avoiding each other by see-and-avoid, hit each other at exactly the rate you would calculate if you assumed that see-and-avoid was completely ineffective. That's the so-called maximum molecule rate. No pilot, I'm not surprised by that. No pilot I've ever talked to is surprised by that. We all know how hard it is to spot traffic. So the equivalent level of safety has long since been achieved. We can fly at random just like manned aircraft can.
Well, this is when you start making friends at the FAA with this.
This is an elementary thing to calculate. You can find the calculation done in an article that runs to less than a page in the Journal of Aircraft in 1983. These are simple calculations. But in any event, see and avoid is a red herring. For two reasons. First, if we want to talk about risk, you have to worry far more about hitting things on the ground than hitting things in the air, for the simple reason that the ground is two-dimensional and the air is three-dimensional. There is nowhere where the density of air traffic is so high and the density of stuff on the ground is so low that the mid-air risk even approaches the hitting stuff on the ground risk. So when I'm flying that aircraft, I'm not too worried about hitting things in the ground, but I'm very concerned about what I'm flying over.
Well, you're
anyway,
a pilot,
that's all about
too,
risk.
Right?
Yeah.
And you are a
yeah,
pilot.
Yeah, and I assure you, when I'm flying around in my own aircraft, I'm certainly not worried about hitting unmanned aircraft. I'm somewhat worried about hitting birds. But there's not a whole lot you can do about that.
No, it's an organic risk. But now we're going to probably run a little long, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Sometimes people complain. We used to do the podcast with 45 minutes, and people are like, oh, they're too long. And I'm like, well, you just turn it off. No, it's too good. Okay, well, you know, I can't help you.
Well, we can come back and talk about other subjects another time.
We could, but I did want to, and I would like to do that, and I would like to invite you to come back down to the Unmanned Expo in late April if you have time, because I thought your last presentation was great. You got so much knowledge to impart on the community, and I think people need to know this history. You got to know where you're from. But I did want to touch on some good news for your company, AeroVel, and the Flex Rotor. And I don't know, you know, if you've been noticing that, but we over here at SUS News are in love with the Flex Rotor. It's on everything. We love it. Aircraft. It's.
Let's
you know,
tell people who want to spend money are in a similar frame of mind.
Well, you know, I'm trying, man. I think you. I think you've got a winner. I mean, your aircraft, and I want you to talk about it. Your aircraft. It looks good. It performs well. It's got. You know, it's got some things that we want to talk about feature-wise and then also regulatory-wise. So maybe you can tell the audience a little bit about the Flex Rotor.
Well, with Flex Rotor, I'm trying to address what really is the fundamental problem for widespread adoption of unmanned aircraft, which is economics. They have been far too expensive all these decades, and that continues to be the situation. There are these little niches developing for electric quadcopters, which can be operated economically, but that's just about the only sector that makes sense. We're interested in a very different sector, which is, again, these long-range applications in remote areas, doing hurricane reconnaissance, two-day missions over thousands of kilometers, doing geomagnetic survey, covering thousands of kilometers, doing reconnaissance from tuna boats where you launch at dawn and you stay up all day and operate tens of miles out from the boat. Well, we want to do this at a cost which makes sense for the tuna ship captain or the geological survey company. So that means operating at a cost in the few hundreds of dollars per flight hour. That's probably a factor of 5 or even 10 better than has been achieved by aircraft and military service. Now, one of the cost drivers has been stuff on the ground. That is, a Scandinavian with Aerosonde, we had aircraft that was quite small. It's, you know, aircraft has a 3-meter wingspan and weighs, say, 15 kilos. So it's easy for a single person to carry it out and so forth. But there is all this stuff that goes with it. On Scan Eagle, there is thousands of kilograms of stuff, a catapult and the so-called skyhook that you need to operate the aircraft. Now, those things enabled applications which were not possible before. I mean, you can take a Scan Eagle and you can operate it off a small boat. But there is this penalty to pay. So with FlexRotor, we're trying to make a much lighter footprint, and we do that with vertical takeoff and landing. So FlexRotor is what was known back in the 1950s as a tail sitter. It has a very big propeller, which operates just like a helicopter rotor when the thing is doing launch and retrieval. And then for efficient cruise, it switches from nose vertical to nose horizontal, and it just has a very big propeller and can fly a long, long way.
And, you know, that's and one other thing before we leave today is maybe you could give the listeners your website. And we ran, SUS News ran some of the, highlighted some of the videos where you were taking off of the, you've got the launch boat. And whatnot, yeah. And it was pretty impressive. So maybe you could give people the website where they could learn more information about your company and the FlexRotor.
Well, it's AeroVelco, Aerovelco. And so our website is aerovelco.com, and the YouTube channel is youtube.com/aerovelco.
Okay.
You can go watch the fun videos on YouTube.
Yeah, and you should go check them out. They're pretty impressive. I like the choices of music. That's pretty good. Excellent. You know, I think this was an excellent podcast. Again, yeah, we'll probably have to have you on again. As always, Tad, it's a pleasure talking to you. I really dig the way that you look at these problems. It's more of a scientific approach, which I keep reminding people that we should maybe go that way. It's a little easier to back up if people ask questions than feelings. But, you know, it's hard changing public opinion. Anyway, that's all for this week. Again, Tad, thanks for coming on, and we'll talk to everyone next week.
Well, thank you. See ya.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.